Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Attention shoppers! Walmart has thousands of fall rollbacks on now to help you get back into routine. Tackle school lunches, yard cleanup, and everything in between. With thousands of rollbacks in-store or online at walmart.ca.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 10th of September. Morocco declares 3 days of national mourning 24 hours after an earthquake killed 2,000 people. There are fears the number could rise. Ukraine criticises leaders of the G20 group of rich nations for issuing a joint statement that fails to condemn Russia over its invasion. And manhunt over.
I stared at him, he stared at me, then I went home and told my husband that it was so odd. I thought he was a drug dealer or something. He wasn't a drug dealer, it was the guy.
3.5 days after a former British soldier and terror suspect escaped from jail, he's recaptured. Also in the podcast, 3 people are killed in the latest clashes at a huge Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. And
the fungus lodges itself onto the host's body, killing it slowly from within. Then in the spring, it erupts out of the head of the dead caterpillar.
The fungus known as Himalayan Viagra that can sell for $5,000 a kilo. Three days of mourning have been declared in Morocco after the strongest earthquake in more than 6 decades. At least 2,000 people were killed, with another 2,000 injured, many of them in critical condition. The number could rise as rescuers reach flattened villages near the epicentre in the High Atlas Mountains. Residents have been using bare hands to try to find people still trapped under the rubble. The relatively shallow quake struck midway between the cities of Agadir and Marrakech. But the tremors were felt in the capital Rabat, some 350 kilometres away, as well as in Casablanca and Essaouira. The Red Cross says it could take years to repair the damage. Landslides blocked the main roads to the affected area, making it difficult for ambulances to get there. Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, has been following the story.
A massive search and rescue operation is underway, and the Moroccan authorities are trying to get food and supplies to people. Marrakech, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, has been very badly damaged. Many hundreds of people slept outside last night in the main square, the Jemaa el Fanar, which means Assembly of the Dead. But the worst place was, as you say, the Atlas Mountains, some 70 kilometres further south. People have been pulled from the rubble, but they say without medical help, they're simply dying. One British woman who lives in a village there said it's freezing cold. She described the scene as apocalyptic. And when the earthquake struck, she said her wall, it was like a square trying to turn into a parallelogram. She said people were crying and screaming. She said that a big hotel owned by the British billionaire Richard Branson was trying to supply food to people. And she said there was a huge sense of community. The villages are inhabited by the local Berber people, and they're incredibly tough and resilient.
Now, international assistance from experts often makes a difference in the early hours following an earthquake. Are they able to get in this case?
Well, that's the big problem, and there's a massive landslide that has blocked one of the main roads south from Marrakech towards the mountains. But helicopters are now trying to get supplies in. And the BBC spoke to a British resident in Marrakech, Peter Mercer.
There's a lot of military involvement, helicopters flying up to the mountains from bases around here, assisting with that. But there's a lot of rubble that needs to be moved, from what I understand, in these little villages where the homes are often built from mud and so on. So they're not strong and perhaps don't have good foundations, which is why they've suffered the most damage.
Richard, tell us more about how people in the area are going to cope.
Well, one of the problems is that high up in the Atlas Mountains, they're still snow-capped. So when the sun goes down, it gets incredibly cold very, very quickly. There are a few houses that are still standing, but people are afraid of going back into those ones in case they collapse again. And we've heard from the president of the local municipality known as Azni. His name's Jamal Imharani. And he said that the authorities are providing tents for people to sleep in.
It's our local authorities and our leader and our premier minister. They're doing a lot of efforts to send tents to make the camps to the people tonight. Our state working very hard with also organizations to help to set camps for the people where they can stay tonight. We will do our best that's happening tonight.
Jamal Imharani of the Azni commune. And how does this earthquake compare to the last big one?
So the last big one was in Agadir in 1960, and this one was stronger. The one in 1960 was 5.8 on the Richter scale, but it was shallower and the epicentre was right in the city. So more than 12,000 people died in Agadir and it had to be completely rebuilt.
Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton. Russia's invasion of Ukraine was always going to be a difficult subject for the G20 group of the world's richest nations to agree on, and so it proved when it came to the wording of their joint declaration at the summit in the Indian capital, Delhi. The statement talks about human suffering in Ukraine, but there was no explicit condemnation of Russia, which, along with China, is a member of the G20. The communique instead calls on all states to refrain from the threat or use of force for, quote, territorial acquisition. Other issues such as climate change and food insecurity were also discussed. But India's Foreign Minister, S. Jaishankar, said Ukraine had taken up much of the focus.
They dwelt on the ongoing war in Ukraine and the impact it has had, especially on developing and least developing nations still recovering from the pandemic and economic disruption.
Ukraine has criticised the declaration, but the G20 host India was always determined to secure some kind of agreement, as I heard from our South Asia correspondent, Yogatila Mai.
I think India was hoping that there would be a joint declaration issued at the end of the summit. And I think it, you know, in that sense, it's been a success because not only has that declaration actually come, it also came much earlier than anyone had expected. So I think after what happened at the G20 Bali summit, where the war in Ukraine was a major sticking point and it took a long time for all parties involved to agree on the wording, I think a lot of work had been started before the meetings actually began in Delhi to arrive at a consensus. We also heard India's Foreign Affairs Minister Jaishankar saying that it was actually developing countries that took the initiative to get to that wording. And of course, when you read the paragraph about the war in Ukraine, the one thing that stands out immediately is that there is no mention of Russia, the Russian Federation, or Moscow. The language has been substantially watered down from the Bali Declaration.
Does this signal a loss of support for the Ukrainians?
I think the Ukrainians are, you know, as they've already said, are pretty disappointed with the wording because, you know, in Bali last year, countries couldn't actually come on an agreement. So, you know, the paragraph was heavily caveated, but it did talk about many countries strongly deploring what they described as Russian aggression in Ukraine. In this one, it's quite a surface level, which says, you know, no member state should be violating the territorial integrity. It should adhere to the UN Charter. It does talk pretty strongly about nuclear weapons, saying even the threat of use and the use of nuclear weapons is inadmissible. Ukraine will definitely see that as a disappointment to them. They are certainly going to wonder about global support for them.
And what else has come out from the summit today?
I think one of the big headlines that has come out of this summit is the inclusion of the African Union as a permanent member of the G20. It's something that India and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi had been very strongly advocating for. They're saying that multilateral groupings of countries, that these need to be truly representative and fair. And that's why Prime Minister Modi in June, in fact, had written a letter to the G20 saying that the African Union must be included. And that happened today. So that's going to be a big win for India.
Yogita Lamai in Delhi. At least three people have been killed after a ceasefire at a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon fell apart in less than 24 hours. Ain El Helweh, near Sidon, which is home to more than 50,000 people, had seen days of deadly clashes back in July. Hundreds of people fled when fighting flared up again on Thursday. A brief ceasefire brought relative calm on Friday night, but it was broken again on Saturday. Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher explains the background to the latest violence.
Essentially, it's a standoff between Fatah, which is the main official Palestinian faction. President Mahmoud Abbas is the head of it. It runs the occupied West Bank from Ramallah, and it controls supposedly the camps in Lebanon. It's facing off challenges from Islamist militants of various militias. That came to a head back in July, which set that violence off with a series of killings. The first killing was of one of these Islamist militants. That then led to an ambush by the Islamist militants who killed five members of Fatah, including a senior leader. The issue that hasn't gone away is that Fatah wants the suspects. There are eight suspects that they're after. And at the moment, these Islamist groups are refusing to hand them over. And I think there was no way that the ceasefire was going to alter that equation and suddenly bring calm. There's plenty of parties who are trying to arrange a ceasefire again or to calm the situation down, as we've seen many times before. I mean, this is a very restive camp. There's been trouble over the years. There's essentially been a struggle for power, and that struggle for power has got fiercer in recent months. This showdown isn't really going to end until these militants who are suspected of the killing of a senior Fatah leader are handed over. I don't think Fatah is going to back down on this.
Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher. Conspiracy theories about viruses and vaccines have exploded in recent years. At the same time, something arguably stranger has spiralled. Our health and disinformation reporter, Rachel Schreyer, has been investigating the rise of germ deniers. In South Africa, a small group influenced by US conspiracy theorists is awakening painful memories.
I've called them kind of the flat earthers of biology, because similar to flat earth, we can, you know, show pictures of the earth being round and people will still deny it.
Dan Wilson has a PhD in molecular biology and a YouTube channel where he debunks health misinformation. Along with more common beliefs, he's seen a growth in groups online who don't believe germs, which cause disease, exist at all. They believe this in the face of centuries of evidence.
We can take the virus and take it and infect animals with it, make it sick. And we can also find that same genetic sequence in humans.
The germ denial conversation hardly existed online before 2020 and grew with the start of the COVID pandemic. But it didn't stop there. It kept growing with higher numbers in 2023 than we saw in the previous 3 years.
I've been interested in alternative health for many, many years. And then, of course, what happened with the coronavirus really just sparked another level of my interest.
Veronica from near Cape Town in South Africa is a typical convert. She moved in wellness circles and already had an interest in health remedies, a step away from so-called mainstream medicine. But the pandemic awakened a deeper mistrust in her and drove her down some information rabbit holes within niche social media messaging groups. Eventually, she found something that denied the very foundations of modern medicine.
I think the whole idea of infectious diseases that you can catch from someone else is an absolute myth that's been perpetuated for many, many decades on humanity, if not centuries.
Instead, she thinks disease is caused by unspecified foreign particles entering the body from toxins in the atmosphere or eating the wrong foods, though she accepts she doesn't have any evidence for what these particles might be. Now she's training to be a naturopath, someone who offers alternative health advice and treatment.
I would absolutely tell all of my clients, your health is in your hands, not in your doctor's hands.
This is where germ denial comes home to roost, because the belief goes hand in hand with a refusal of medicines and vaccines, as Dan Wilson points out.
The germ theory denial and anti-vaccine crowds definitely have a lot of overlap.
In South Africa, where Veronica lives, a small overlapping group of influencers have edged towards something with a more troubling history. Roberto Pereira was working as an HIV researcher in Johannesburg during the COVID pandemic. he observed certain influencers who once appeared on the nightly news to give opposing views on lockdowns starting to become more radical in their views.
So at first it was that, COVID wasn't even a major issue at all, and then the goalposts move and then it was that people were being misdiagnosed, and then the posts get moved even further. I saw a couple of months ago they were hosting an actual AIDS denialist.
It brings back bad memories for people like Roberto, who are keenly aware of the very real consequences of HIV denial. In the early 2000s, South Africa's president, Thabo Mbeki, on the basis of bad information, refused to accept the link between HIV and AIDS and to provide life-saving antiretroviral drugs.
Rachel Schreier with that report. The outspoken Zulu chief, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, has died. A towering figure in South African politics, he joined the African National Congress as a young man, but broke away, forming the Zulu Inkatha Party in 1975. People in Johannesburg gave their reaction to his death.
It's very sad because he was one of the forefront leaders to defeat apartheid. It's very shocking and sad. We know and understand his age, but we're all sad, yeah.
I know that he was the leader of the IFP, Inkatha Freedom Party, and he was also involved in the Kingdom of KwaZulu-Natal. So he's a fallen hero.
My South African colleague, Audrey Brown, spoke to Paul Henley about the impact of Mr. Buthelezi.
I think he was a very important figure in 20th century South African history, both during the period before the democratic breakthrough in 1994, when Nelson Mandela became the first democratically elected president in the country, and subsequent to that. His role was, one could say, ambiguous. On the international stage, he appeared to be fighting the apartheid regime in South Africa, the white minority regime, and he made all the right noises. Inside the country, though, he was seen very clearly to be on the side of the apartheid regime. He was seen as a moderate by right-wing forces like Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of Britain at the time, and Ronald Reagan. What they really wanted to do was to destroy the ANC's legitimacy. So they saw him as the acceptable face of the struggle against apartheid and the struggle for freedom.
Pretty recently, on his 90th birthday, he said he'd made mistakes and he asked forgiveness for them. Do you think that he's been forgiven, as he put it, in South Africa now?
I would say perhaps yes, because memory softens and there's a younger generation that comes in. But there are people who remember the thousands of people who were killed at the hands of forces that he commanded, Inkatha Impi, as they were called at the time. These were men that he could call on to go into townships in South Africa that would kill pro-ANC or opposing forces to him. He denied it. It won't be easy for South Africans, those that remember and suffered, to give him a free pass, as it were. And of course, I think one of his lasting legacies, really, in South Africa, was his stance that leaders should speak openly about HIV and AIDS, because his children died of it. And at the time, people talking about it were a taboo. So he did that openly and declared it. I think perhaps people would remember him more kindly.
BBC presenter Audrey Brown talking to Paul Henley. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Before the pandemic, people used to joke the three great enemies of work from home are the bed, the fridge and the television, and people would fall victim to one of them.
Could this be why big companies are ordering their staff to stop working from home? For 3.5 days, he was the most wanted man in Britain. But Daniel Khalif is now back in custody after being caught just a few kilometres away from the prison he broke out of on Wednesday morning by clinging to the underside of a supply lorry. He was being held in Wandsworth Jail in London, accused of preparing an act of terrorism and collecting information useful to an enemy state. He denies the charges. Our reporter Ellie Price told me how he was apprehended.
It all started in something that sounded a bit like it was out of a movie. Daniel Khalif was Taking part in his audacious prison break, he strapped himself to the bottom of a delivery van that whisked him out of Wandsworth Prison. He then disappeared for a few days until there were sightings last night in Chiswick in West London, which was about 8 kilometres or so up from the prison. This morning, at about 20 to 11 British time, he was arrested a few miles on from that, up in Northolt along a canal. Now, the details surrounding his arrest were far less dramatic than his original escape. He was basically, we're told, shoved off a pushbike by a counter-terrorism police officer in plain clothes who saw him. When he was arrested, we're told he was cooperative, handcuffed, and as I say, went away really without any problems. The wider details of exactly how this happened, well, that's very much subject to an investigation at the moment. Was he helped from the inside? Was he helped from the outside? Was he acting alone? These are all details we don't yet know, but as I say, the crucial piece of information is that Daniel Khalif back in custody.
Yeah, there was even speculation he'd been helped to escape by a foreign state. What happens next in this case?
Well, as you would imagine, this has obviously been a massive manhunt involving hundreds of police officers around London trying to find him. But obviously it's raised huge issues here in the UK and with politicians as much as security chiefs as how this could happen. It's raised questions of how well our prison services are working here in the UK, whether they're understaffed, whether they're resourced correctly. The British government will launch an inquiry this week into exactly what happened. We're told there will be a result of that inquiry by the end of the week. Government clearly trying to look like they're on top of this and learn lessons.
Ellie Price reporting. Counting is continuing in the presidential election in the Maldives. It's being seen as a two-horse race between the current president, Ibrahim Mohamed Saleh, who wants to establish closer ties with India, and Mohamed Muizu, who has taken an early lead and who has a history of being close to China. Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan, has more on the significance of the vote.
It is one of the very hotly contested elections. There are 8 candidates in the fray, but the main contest seems to be between the incumbent Mohamed Ibrahim Soleh and his rival Mohamed Muizu. It's a coalition is backing Mr. Muizu, and it is known for being close to China. For many Maldivians, there are issues like escalating cost of living, corruption in the government, youth unemployment. And it is a small population of about 500,000 people and only 282,000 eligible voters. But if you look at it in a broader context, what's happening is also what else you see in the South Asian region of how the two Asian powers are competing for influence in other countries like in Sri Lanka or in Nepal. The same thing happening in the Maldives. And now Ibrahim Soleh is seen someone as very close to India. He has re-established ties with India, with which the country has very strong cultural and financial links. Whereas there is also a growing anti-India sentiment within Maldives. And China has also invested hundreds of millions of dollars in building this infrastructure, bridges and many apartment blocks. I was there a couple of years ago to see the Chinese investment. So that is why people see that even though it is a Maldivian election, it is also seen as a rivalry between India and China.
And Marisan Etirajan. Now to the search for a fungus called Yasagumba. It grows out of the body of a dead caterpillar and it's an aphrodisiac, which might explain why thousands of people hike up the mountains in Nepal every year to get their hands on it. Known as the Viagra of the Himalayas, it sells for a fortune in East Asia. But now the Nepalese government is changing the guidelines to streamline the trade. Lipika Pelham has the details.
In your local grocery store, button mushrooms go for about $2 a box. Shiitakes cost about twice that. And black truffles can run a few hundred dollars per kilogram. But that's nothing compared to the Himalayan fungus, Yasagumba, that can fetch up to $5,000 a kilo. The host caterpillar buries itself down a couple of inches into the soil. Meanwhile, the fungus, Yasagumba, lodges itself onto the host's body, killing it slowly from within. Then in the spring, it erupts out of the head of the dead caterpillar. This pinky-sized mummified caterpillar is then picked, dried, preserved, and sold for the price one would hope to get from selling diamonds or gold. So what makes it so expensive? Well, it's also known as the Viagra of the Himalayas. Yasagumba means summer plant, winter insect in Tibetan, but it's neither a plant nor an insect and is only found at altitudes above 3,500 meters. Mentioned in a 15th century Tibetan medicinal text titled an ocean of aphrodisiac qualities, the fungus is treated by East Asian rich men as a status symbol. So, for example, when a wealthy businessman in China wants to impress his guests, instead of pulling out a fine French vintage bottle of wine, he'd present a roast duck filled with thousands of dollars worth of yassagumba. Because it's so valuable, yassagumba has also led to violence. Men went missing over disputes while harvesting the fungus, and bodies were discovered at the bottom of steep gorges. In May this year, it was reported that 3 Himalayan Viagra pickers were feared dead and another 12 were injured after being hit by an avalanche. Now, Nepal's Ministry of Forest and Environment has taken action to stop what it calls excessive harvest. The Nepalese proposals include setting a limit of 30 days per person gathering the fungus and the setting up of camps for the harvesters.
Lipika Pelham there. Now, it wasn't so long ago that almost all office meetings were on Zoom, Teams or Skype as employees were told to work from home during the COVID pandemic. Many people are still happy with remote working, but big firms want their staff back in the office. The Lloyds Banking Group says people must work from the office at least twice a week and have offered free food as an enticement. Zoom is doing the same with employees who live within 80 kilometres of an office. So does this spell the beginning of the end of working from home? Julian Warwicker spoke to Nicholas Bloom, Professor of Economics at Stanford University in California.
We're now in this flat phase. Folks are not going back into the office particularly. There was an enormous surge early in the pandemic. It's been falling, so folks have been slowly returning back. We've now kind of leveled out. So the last 6 months to a year, been pretty stable. Looking ahead, maybe next year after, I think work from home is going to start to grow again. That's really been the long run trend. As technology improves, more people move to working remotely.
But some companies, I mean, the Lloyds Banking Group here in the UK, for example, telling its employees they must turn up at the office for at least 2 days a week, enticing them to do that. Some are clearly sceptical about this, aren't they?
What we see overall is pretty much all big companies requiring managers, professionals back, but it's typically 3 days a week, sometimes four, sometimes as little as two. That seems to have stabilised. And interestingly enough, they don't get reported as much, but I talk to a lot of smaller companies that are starting to let some employees go fully distributed. They're saying, you know, it's expensive having an office. These folks are really only coming in 1 day a week. Why don't we just let them be fully remote, save a lot of money with that office space? The other thing you have to look at is some of the back office operations. So take Lloyds or Amazon or Zoom. Sure, managers, professionals may be coming in 2-3 days a week, but often they're saying things like call centers, data entry, HR, some IT support. These folks are a lot cheaper to be fully remote. A, you don't need an office, but you can also hire people internationally. If you're sat in North America, it can be far cheaper to hire, you know, part of your IT team in Brazil, some in India, Nigeria. So what we tend to see in big companies is things going in both directions, you know.
What's it doing for productivity, or is it too early to say that?
There's two very different stories. One is hybrid, the classic hybrid, you know, the vanilla flavor is in the office Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, work from home Monday, Friday. That looks like it's about flattened productivity. On the positives, you don't have to commute twice a week, and that's pretty tiring. And it's generally quieter at home. But then, of course, you get less face time. You may ask, why would anyone do hybrid? And the reason is it is popular with employees. It makes it easier to recruit and retain staff. The other flavor is fully remote, where you work from home 5 days a week, week in, week out. That looks like it maybe reduces productivity by about 10%. There's a number of studies on this now.
That's interesting. And what's that about? Is that simply because if you're at home and nobody's with you, you can go off and do something else for a few moments, or you don't feel the same appetite for it because you're not with colleagues?
One story is definitely what's often called self-motivation. Before the pandemic, people used to joke the three great enemies of work from home are the bed, the fridge and the television, and people would fall victim to one of them. I think that's definitely a thing. You know, I teach a lot of students at Stanford, and many of them do go into the library because they feel like it's going to make me work harder.
Nicholas Bloom, a professor of economics at Stanford University in California. Louis Garrel has been a star of French cinema for 20 years. At the age of 40, he's directed his third feature film, The Innocent, which he describes as a half film noir and half rom-com. But he says he's worried that French filmmakers may be losing their ability to produce blockbusters with global appeal. Vincent Dowd has been talking to him.
Hello, I'm Louis Garrel. I'm the director and the actor of the film The Innocent.
Qu'est-ce que tu vas faire maintenant pour une interview? Bah, je vais faire un peu d'intérim.
From an acting family, Louis Garrel first appeared on film aged six. At 19, he acted in Bernardo Bertolucci's controversial The Dreamers. Hitting 40 in France, he's now busy as an actor and director. The heist movie The Innocent was his idea.
First desire was to make like a very French noir, like a thriller and also like a rom-com. So I wanted to mix different genres. When you write a noir film, you have the risky stuff. It's to try to imitate Michael Mann, for example, because for a noir movie, you have an action scene. If you're not aware of this risk, you can do like an American imitation. Then I said to myself and to the screenwriter, okay, we are French, so we have to inject lots of love in the action scene of the film.
But when he's working on a screenplay, does Louis Garrel think about how well a French story will play elsewhere?
All the time, because there is two ways of being French. So there is a way of being too French with comic references inside the country where an English guy can get the jokes. But there is a good way to be like super French, to be interesting for an English guy. So it's a very small frontier, because most of the time it's the sense of humor that I'm trying to make trip.
I would say the French sense of humor and the British sense of humor are quite different.
Totally different.
I'm Josephine March.
Oh. I'm Josephine, is that you? Welcome!
4 years ago, Louis Garrel appeared in the American film Little Women. Pre-Barbie, director Greta Gerwig was so keen to cast him, she changed his character from German to French. Making a Hollywood film in English didn't feel very different, which he credits to Gerwig's intelligence as a director.
Because Greta is completely fascinated by the European cinema, so there was no difference, because she's very concentrated about the actors and the acting. The thing that I loved with Greta, that she was super concentrated, and I felt that she was listening what I was doing.
This is a beautiful instrument. Which one of you plays?
Oh, it was my sister Beth.
It is very hard to lose a sister. I'm sorry.
Some directors, as long as the actors are standing there and are saying their lines, they're happy. Which kind of director are you?
Most of the time I'm working with the actors, because this is the part of making a movie that I'm obsessed about. You know what? Sometimes when a director has a style who is very strong, his films can be very good, even if the actors are not so good. There is no method, that there is no general law.
D'Artagnan, vous êtes le fils d'Achille?
Oui.
Louis Garrel recently appeared in The Three Musketeers, an expensive two-part attempt to make a popular French hit for a world audience. But for now, the international appeal of earlier films, such as Amélie or The Artist, seems to be evading French filmmakers.
Every 2 or 3 years, we'd have a film like Amélie. There would be a huge French film internationally. That doesn't seem to happen now.
This is also what Dimitri Rassam, who's a producer of The Three Musketeers, tried to reactivate, to create some French blockbuster who have like an international life. But I agree with you. We need to have like big movies who are entertaining and super easy to watch and also very good qualities, of course. I'm always dreaming as an actor and also as a director, to be honest, to make a movie who has this kind of quality, but it's also very appeals for a large audience.
Louis Garrel talking to Vincent Dowd. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Alana Bowles and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Attention shoppers! Walmart has thousands of fall rollbacks on now to help you get back into routine. Tackle school lunches, yard cleanup, and everything in between. With thousands of rollbacks in-store or online at walmart.ca.